Once more unto the breach, dear friends, else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning again, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and I am Jake McClure. Jeff is still off in the beautiful paradise land of Colorado. It's paradise all winter long, or all summer long, winter for us, over there. We generally are doing this together, so if you want to add to the conversation and help pep up my semi-sleeping brain, or as my dad likes to say, the semi-somnolent brain, please do. I would very much appreciate that. What is the Personal Wealth Coach? Well, the Personal Wealth Coach, this radio program, obviously, we're talking about things that are affecting the economy, and then that's kind of at the broadest scale, and then narrowing down into personal finance and decisions that you can make to hopefully better your future, and maybe even increase your comfort and peace of mind today. We're also, other than being a radio program, the Personal Wealth Coach is an SEC-registered investment advisory firm offering fiduciary investment advice. What we do on the air here is not fiduciary investment advice. It's not investment advice at all. It's education. Investment advice is something that would have to be custom tailored to you, knowing your situation, your everything about who you are and where you're trying to go. That's fiduciary advice, and it's I think very important. But it's really good to have a foundation in the general concepts of what's being talked about when you get to that sort of thing. And that's why we do this radio program, because as far as I can tell, there's no readily available and easy source of education on personal finance and economics in general. What does it mean when people talk about the market? So we'll be talking some about that today. What are some other disclosures we've got to give here? We do not pay for this radio program. However, we do buy advertising on the station throughout the week. We've carefully asked them not to play our ad during our program. It's basically because we're doing this to give back educationally. We do occasionally get clients from it. Not very many, but some. It's probably more useful to our existing clients that are listening. And if you're listening right now, I appreciate it. And if you're not, well, it doesn't matter because you can't hear me anyway. All right. So what happened this week in the market? The S&P 500 rose about 0.96% for the week to close at 3,007.39. Well, what does that mean? It's 20 points below where it was about 6 weeks ago. Very close to that long-term record-breaking area again. Why? Well, we've had 8 weeks in a row of positive returns. Why? Well, it's because there's no really known data, but the rumors are all saying that the trade talks are going on with the government. Or it may just be that people are optimistic about what it might be. The Chinese government this last week announced a suspension of tariffs on at least some of the pork and soybean imports that it had already imposed the tariff on. And that was their response to President Trump's short-term deferral of tariffs. It was going to start October 1st, and he moved back to December 1st. Does that mean that negotiations are progressing well? We don't know. People are making guesses based on the reality of what we do know. And when these things happen, they can lead to interesting events. So that's another subject for later in the day or later in the hour. There was an interesting blip on the stock exchanges on Thursday morning that I'd like to talk about. It's one of those things that on the surface, it doesn't look like that big a deal at all. It's just a weird anomaly, but there's some really cool stuff underneath it. So we'll talk about that. All right. So what was the big news this week? Well, let me kind of finish up on the markets here too. The yield of the 10-year U.S. Treasury note rose about 40 basis points. Well, what's a basis point? A 100th of 1%. So 40 one-hundredths, almost half a percent. That's a big, big deal. Rose to about 1.898, about, and then I give you three decimal points. It estimated at about to the ninth decimal point. All right, so that means we're getting up very, very close to the 1.9% rate or yield on a 10-year treasury. Why is that important? Because the treasury yield curve is still inverted. The short-term loans are still slightly higher as far as yield than the longer-term loans. And that's predicting a danger for the future of the economy, and it's predicting it by being a danger itself. It's making it harder to make loans because you would think, well, this is a better time to get a loan because interest rates are so low. Well, the problem with that is that the bank has to give you the loan before you can have that interest rate that low, and they're very, very reluctant to give loans at this low interest rate because they're being locked in for a long period of low profit. And we can talk more about that in just a minute as well. So we've got a couple of good subjects lined up this morning on what's going on out there. We're going to talk about some more news for the week, and then I'm going to start in on the fascinating concepts, at least fascinating to me, of what happened on Thursday morning and what happened Thursday afternoon in Europe. What happened, and Thursday afternoon happened before Thursday morning, which isn't always fun when talking datelines and time zones. It's a weird, it's almost like doing quantum mechanics. Wait, this says it happened before that. Well, it was in a different time zone. Okay. The Commerce Department released its first estimate of what happened in the U.S. economy during the month of August. There's good news in here. There's bad news in here. There's mediocre news in here. The headlines are going to do, depending on which way the newspaper is leaning, which way the newscast is leaning, they're going to concentrate on either the good news, the bad news, or the mediocre news. They rarely cover all three, and I think that's kind of important to know what's really going on. So I've got a call on 773-1400. Hold on just a minute. We'll be right with you. I'm going to finish up this Commerce Department thing. The good news: vehicle purchases jumped 1.8% from July into August. That's a direct response to lower interest rates. It caused home or car buying to be something that looks relatively inexpensive. Vehicle purchases were the driver. Let's see what we did there. There's a little pun in that. Yeah, I know. If I have to explain the joke, it's not funny. I get it. I get it. Vehicle purchases were the driver in raising retail sales. So, the retail sales were up 0.4% for the month. That's good news. That's a big jump in one month. The other side of the story is that except for vehicles, spending on most retail purchases was the same. It was flat. And what we've had month by month going through this year is a lot of other negative signs showing up in the economy, but consumer spending still ramping up and accelerating. Well, it doesn't look like it's accelerating anymore. And in that same time period, we had some consumer confidence numbers come back to say that confidence is dropping. So the thing that's been really sustaining us to now is consumer spending, and that's kind of slowing. We'll talk more about that in a minute, and I'll cover some other stuff that unemployment numbers that came out and word from the Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank, all that good stuff. But in the meantime, I have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Good morning, Mr. McClure. I just wanted to ask you a simple question here, get my business out of the way so you can take care of yours. This concerns credit scores. I've had a credit score for about a 690 for a long period of time, and I pay all my bills current. I don't ever have no late charges. How do you go about getting your credit score to jump up? And there's people with 800 credit scores. What do they do? Just buy a brand new car and pay it off in 3 months? You know, how do you go about getting your credit score up more instead of where it's stuck at. You have a very good day, sir, and I enjoyed listening to you.
Okay, don't hang up. I've got a couple of questions for you. Are you still there? Ah, lost him. Okay. Then we'll just do this generally. Kind of across the board. The first thing to know about the credit score. It is the most important piece of information you will hear about credit scores, is the credit score was not designed to give you good financial health. I know that's earth-shaking news. Credit scores were designed by banks to figure out who were the most profitable people to lend to. Not designed by financial specialists to figure out the best financial health and well-being score for a person. Those are different things. What does that mean? Well, in the ultimate best case scenario, someone has no debt. They paid it all off. They're financially independent and no longer have a job. So their job is their financial independence. They get it from their investments and everything else. So they buy everything with cash. Their credit score is going to be abysmally low. They've got very little credit record because their loans aren't being tracked. So the banks don't really care how financially savvy you are in that credit score. What they're interested in is how profitable you are. So know that at a very deep level when you start getting into gaming the credit score. Now I'll tell you how to game it. But before I tell you that, let me emphasize what I just said again, because it is really important. You can hurt yourself by raising your credit score. Making yourself more attractive to the banks does not make it better for you all the time. Okay. First off, what is a credit score? Credit score is, there's different institutions that give them out, and this can be misleading. The Fair Isaac credit score is the most common, and that has an upper area in the mid-800s. There are other credit scores that are issued by other institutions, and they're trying to compete, but they're not as common, and then top score numbers are different. So you might be told by some credit institution that you've got a credit score of 720, or even more confusing, you have a credit score of 800. But if it's on a scale of with 1,000 at the top, it's very different than the Fair Isaac one, where you're up and near the very top of all the people scoring. So keep that in mind too. We're going to keep in mind just the Fair Isaac, and that's one the three major credit reporting services. Experian and I'm going to have to look them all up. Let's see here. Three credit bureaus. The three credit bureaus are Equifax, Experian, and where is the other one? My brain is a little bit fried this morning. Having a three-month-old baby is fun. This is something that would just have flown trippingly from my head, my tongue a few months ago. Okay. TransUnion. I don't know why I didn't remember that. That's like a easy one to remember. Okay. Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion. What do? They gather data from the banks. The banks voluntarily feed this data to these three credit firms. Why? Okay. So I'm going to reel back and give you the real reason why the credit score exists, and then how it turned into something that you and I talk about. Originally, it wasn't even something that the banks told you about. They didn't say you had a score. It was hush-hush. Because at the beginning, one bank giving loans, they had your record. That's it. Your record at their bank. They didn't know what you had done at any other banks. They could look at the county records to see if you had had a bankruptcy. This is way before the massive computer revolution. So they could go down to the county and pull bankruptcy records and try to see if you're in there anywhere. That was it. So they started talking to each other, saying, hey, this person was really late on their loans for 3 months in a row. You might want to watch out for them because we've got loans to you. You're the other bank and you have loans to us. If you fail, we're in trouble. So I'm going to tell you about this person. And it's kind of like a way of blacklisting, but with some forgiveness. Okay. So over time, they customized this score, and bigger networks of banks were using them until the credit unions, the credit bureaus. These are the bureaus that put together all the credit information on these people. It's voluntary. So there's some people that you get a loan from that won't report to any of the credit bureaus. And that's a lot of the newer loan organization companies won't report. So it won't help you or hurt you to have a loan from them. And they may not even ask about your credit score. They may not log into Equifax, Experian, TransUnion, anything to figure out what your record is. All right, so how do they set it up? And the caller said, what happens, how do they get their credit score up so high? Do they just get a loan and pay it off in 3 months? No, they get a loan and pay it off in an extremely long period of time. They get a loan that's nowhere near the maximum amount that they could get. So some of the things that improve your credit score that are not good for you healthily and your own financial health. If you have the ability to be out of debt without hurting yourself, it's, you know, most investment advisors, fiduciaries, financial advisors would say, hey, that's probably a pretty good idea. You'll get that out of the way. If we have some kind of catastrophic event in the market, you'll have credit lined up and ready for you because you don't have it all filled up. So it seems like a good idea. Just pay it off. The banks don't like that. How do banks make money? Banks don't make money by giving you a loan that's supposed to last for 30 years and then getting paid back right away. Banks make money by you paying the minimum payment on your loan every month for as long as possible while you don't have way too much debt. And if you keep that in mind, that's how you raise your credit score. Those are the major things to keep in mind in keeping a credit score up. If the first thing to know, closing a credit card or a loan account can bring your credit score down. Having open credit that you're not using brings your credit score up because one of the factors that's looked at in a credit score is the percentage of your available loans that you're holding. And if you're down around 20%, that's kind of the sweet spot for the banks. They like that. You've only borrowed out about 20% of what you could. You're making payments on it at the very low way so that you are stuck at that 20% debt for forever, basically. That's the perfect bank customer. They will always make money off of this person. This person will not go bankrupt. According to this, this is their long-term thought. You've got this long credit history of making payments in that category. So the way you get your credit score up has nothing to do with your income or the amount of cash that you have on hand. It's simply a matter of making your payments on time and keeping the percentage of debt that you owe down around 20% of what you could make, of what you could get a loan for. Having a mortgage is really, really helpful for your credit score. If you don't have a mortgage, your credit score is going to be lower than somebody that does with the same exact background as you. And the reason is because the credit score goes up when you're more profitable to the banks, and getting a mortgage is more profitable to the banks. That's something important to remember. I've emphasized this enough times. People should be getting it. Credit scores are important if you want to get a loan. You should game them if you're thinking about buying a house, getting a business loan. There's a whole bunch of reasons why you should game them. And you start a few years in advance of the thing that you're trying to accomplish. But you can raise your credit score relatively quickly by paying down debt to the 20% mark. Something else that will knock your credit down, it seems like the opposite of what I've just said, is applying for credit. So if you say, hey, I don't have enough money to knock my credit score down or my loans down to 20% of what's available, I'm going to apply for some more credit cards and raise the max amount up. That long term can be a really good thing to do for your credit score. But short term, every new application that you send out that has a credit score check knocks down your credit score. Even if you didn't get the loan. Why? Well, because to a bank, it means you're shopping around and trying to get maybe more than one loan at the same time. And the banks need to know, if you're applying for a loan with me, are you also applying for a loan with somebody else? If you are, we could be looking at data that's outdated on how much you owe, because you may already be approved for a mortgage over there, and now you're getting a big business loan with me. So the number of credit applications you put in a short period of time can have a really fast negative effect on your credit score. Those tend to have little to no effect on your credit score after about 12 months or 18 months. So if you feel like you're never going to get yourself down to that 20% mark, you might want to open some credit cards. This is horrible advice on a personal level. So this is at a educational level to bring down the credit score, or bring up the credit score. Getting more credit cards years in advance and then not using them is one of the ways that you can raise your credit score. There's a lot of ways to game the system. The big question to ask before you get started is, why should I? If you are not interested in buying another home in your life, or not in the next 5 years, it shouldn't matter to you. If you're not trying to go out and get a big loan of some kind, the credit score thing is not an issue. It's important to keep a healthy credit score. And the caller said he was in the 620 range. That's not bad. It may be that you're closing your credit card accounts when you get them paid off. Or it may be that you're closing your store credit accounts when you get them paid off. Store credit is obscene. It usually charges way too much interest, even the ones that say, hey, we'll charge 0% for 12 months. If you are late on one payment, or you don't make all the payments in the 12-month period to have the whole thing paid off, they can retroactively charge you interest for that whole first year. It's pretty gross, pretty disgusting, but they can do it. So when people come to me and say, should I close this account, my first question isn't, do you like the company, or are you planning on using their services anymore? That's irrelevant in my mind when talking about these things. First question is, you've got it paid off. Are you about to get a big loan? Are you planning on buying a house or moving? Are you planning on getting a loan of any kind? If they say no, I say, close that nasty thing. And if they are planning on getting a loan, I say, hang on to it for a while. It'll help your credit score until you get your new loan, whatever it is, and then cancel it. Cancel that nasty store credit. So I hope that helped with the answer to the caller. There's a lot more information on this, and you can look it up online. There's quite a lot of places that you can look at this. I wouldn't recommend spending too much doing this, because what you're doing by spending all this time, it's basically you are trying to shape yourself in the mold of a perfect bank customer. You should only do that if you need to be a bank customer. If you don't need to be a bank customer, you should be you. Paying your debt on time is good for you, and that has no bearing on whether or not you're trying to get a loan. It's just good for you long term. Health, your psychological health and your financial well-being will thank you for it over the long term. So what I tend to tell people is, go down the different route of actually making good, healthy financial decisions for you. And over time, your credit score will reflect that. The banks will be looking at you as the customer that's playing a little hard to get. You're really healthy. They would really like you to fit their mold. And so they may over time offer you incentives to do it. 0% interest cards come in. You get a few of them and you leave them open after you've paid them off. As long as they don't have an annual charge on them, it doesn't cost you anything to do. Now, they'll come behind you by 3 years. If you haven't any activity in a card, they may close your account, and that'll lower your credit score a little bit. And that's not in your control. So depending on how much you want to game it, what you do is you switch credit cards every month, so that you're making your charges on the new credit card each year. Say you have 5 credit cards, and each month you switch from one to the next to the next, and then you pay them off every month. That gives you an average daily balance on your credit score of about the same amount, but it gives you activity on each of your cards so the cards don't close you. You can see how you can go down a rabbit hole really fast doing this. You can try to game the system, but the benefit hopefully is worth all the time and effort you put into it. Now, if you just enjoy it, if you enjoy pulling one over on the banks, what I would say is don't go down the gaming the credit score route. Once you get your credit score relatively healthy, there's another way that you can pull one over on the banks, and that's when you get those offers that say if you spend $1,500 in the first 3 months, you get $150 back. Well, what is that? Well, if you're already spending, on average, $500 a month on your credit card, and then you're paying it off every month, get that thing. You just got free money. Pay it off, and then don't use it anymore. They just gave you $150. That's the way you game the system. Credit score's sort of important to that, but a much smaller priority than where's the free money coming from. Now, the danger in that, the reason why they offer the free money, is the vast majority of people do not have the discipline to pay their credit cards off every month. So that free money is actually money long-term that you're going to pay them back for all the interest payments and so on. And I've got a caller on 773-1400. I'll be jumping back to the other subjects later in the show. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Enjoy the show. There's an opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal today about Elizabeth Warren's assault on retiree wealth. She's got something called a Accountable Capitalism Act. I'm just curious if you're aware of that. One of the statements in this article, it says it's the fiduciary responsibility of every investment advisor to tell its clients what would happen under this bill. So don't mean to put you on the spot, but are you aware of this, and how would it affect most investors? Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for that question. It's a pretty good one. All right. So here's the basics of it. And I won't go into a great deal of detail because Elizabeth Warren hasn't gone into a great deal of detail. She's only done the broad strokes of what she's talking about here. It's in essence a tax on wealth, kind of like property tax, where they say, what is the value of your property? Give me a percentage of that. What is dangerous about this? Why is it that fiduciary responsibility is brought up for investment advisors to become familiar with this and tell their clients? Well, it is a tremendous danger to think of investments in that category. The way we tax investments, or most investments right now, and not all of them, there's a lot of different ways we tax, but the vast majority of investments are taxed at the capital gains rate. Well, what is a capital gain? A capital gain. Capital, what does that mean? Well, in Latin, that means head. A head game? Head gain. There's a tax on gaining heads. What does it mean? When the value of something rises based on what people are willing to pay for it, how is it they determine what they're willing to pay for it? They do it by thinking about it. So if you think of capital gain as what people believe your gains are, then you have realized and unrealized. Unrealized means that people just think it's worth that. You haven't sold it. If you sell it later, it might be worth more or less. If it's worth less and you paid taxes on it when it was worth more, you didn't actually receive any income from that. And you paid taxes on a value that wound up being less. Okay, so capital gains is a really good way of taxing investments. It's not the best way, but it's in essence, it's a sales tax. It's only a sales tax on the gains in your investment. Because here's the premise. You take some money. The money came to you through your job. You've paid taxes on it, income taxes. Now you turn around and you invest it. The money that you put in that investment is after-tax money. Okay, so you invested in a corporation. Well, the corporation is paying taxes. They've got employees. They've got to pay employment taxes. If they pay dividends, they're paying taxes, income taxes on it before the dividend's paid out. If you receive the dividend, you have a dividend tax on top of it. So there's lots of taxation already going on in this corporation at the running level. And yet, for some reason, this particular investment is going up. It's gone up. Okay. So you've got some gain in there. But you don't know how long it's going to be up. And tomorrow it could be down. If today is tax deadline and they take your valuation there and you owe taxes on the amount, even though you haven't sold anything, you owe a percentage of that, where are you going to get the money to pay the tax? And this is the big question. This is the secondary repercussion of the tax. Well, if you don't have a lot of cash on hand, that's not what they're taxing you for. They're not taxing you on the money that you made. They're taxing on what you own. So you don't have a lot of cash on hand. Well, now you have to go sell some of what you own and give it to the government. Okay, that seems reasonable too. Okay, except one step further removed. What happens to the price of a stock, any stock, all stocks, if the day of valuation for tax purposes leads to a tax bill to most people that have stocks? The prices of those stocks drop drastically in advance of the date that the taxation will be done, because people are selling in advance to try to realize some of that money so that they'll have it on hand, so they don't have this cliff-like drop on the day after the valuation where everybody goes and reaches for selling their stocks so that they can pay the tax. This is one of the problems with a property tax as well, the ad valorem tax, the taxes on your house. It's dealt with directly with people that have fixed incomes by saying, all right, you have some exemptions at retirement age, you have exemptions for disability. But the reality is that there are a lot of places where property taxes are the reason that forces people to move out of a house that they love, that they fully have paid for. So when you add an extra incentive to sell, it has a negative consequence on the pricing of the market. I know that seems like a pretty common sense statement once it's come all these ramifications in. It's a downward pressure on the prices of corporations that has nothing to do with how they're run. It is it's a move that's based directly on you must sell them because you need the money to pay taxes. You must sell them not because they're doing poorly or because you wish to do something with it. So it's an inefficient way of taxation. Is it a bad method? No more bad than most other forms of taxation. Taxes, by definition, get in the way of profit making. Oh yeah, big shock there. Because some of it goes to someone else, the government. So taxation, this is one of those rough ones. A wealth tax, let's expand it up to the ultra wealthy. A wealth tax on somebody like Jeff Bezos, the owner of Amazon and the Washington Post and Blue Origins and a bunch of other little things and big things. So how much of his fortune does he hold in cash positions? Well, we don't know for sure, but most people of ultra high net worth have somewhere below 1% of their entire net worth in cash positions. Now, that 1% is really, really big compared to the rest of our bank accounts. And so it's spread out all over the place to get the best insurance on it. Sometimes it's concentrated in one thing and they bought extra insurance on it. It costs more money to house more money. I know that's a weird thing. Rich people are the first people that wind up paying the negative interest rate on deposits, because they want the insurance that at lower levels is basically free. Okay, so that's another thing to keep in mind as you go around it. If the more money you have, the more expensive it is to house it. So you want less money on hand. Okay, so Jeff Bezos, going along about his day, new tax form comes through, says you are now taxed on some percentage, and that percentage is not stated by Elizabeth Warren yet. It could be 1% or it could be 40%. Either of them would be inefficient. 40% would pretty much tank the economy, the whole thing. Because if Jeff Bezos is taxed at the income tax rate on what he owns, He's got to sell what he owns, which could lead to him losing control of the corporation. And also, here's the tough one. When applied to small businesses, so any tax should be able to be applied at each level to test for efficiency. When applied to a small business, it could cause the business to go out of business. So this is very much like the valuation method for the estate tax, what used to be known as the death tax by the Republicans. They pretty much ignored it for a while because we've raised the limit. So let's say you're a family that's owned a ranch for 9 generations in Fredericksburg, Texas, and it's a beautiful ranch, and a bunch of Hollywood people are coming in and buying the land nearby, and they're setting up mansions, so your property's going up in value. And then you die. Well, under the old system, you only had about $600,000 of protection before you went up into a really obscenely high tax bracket, way above the income tax brackets for the estate tax. You've already paid taxes on everything in what you did to buy this stuff, and now suddenly you owe taxes again. Well, this was the problem with the estate tax. It needed to be raised up, make it higher. It caused the people in that situation, if they own this big ranch that hasn't been worth a lot of money because it doesn't have, I mean, you may be able to put one head of cattle on 10 acres. And if they've got 1,000 acres, well, that's barely enough to make a living. But the land itself has suddenly become so valuable that the only way to pay taxes on the land is to sell the land. And the valuation that the IRS imposed and still imposes for the estate tax, there's 7 different methods that they apply, and then they choose the highest of the 7. And then generally they give you a deadline that says you have until the end of the year, December 31st, to pay this bill. Well, if somebody in the family died at the end of November, that means you have 1 month to come up with the cash on the valuation of that property. You may have to sell that land at a fire sale, which means you get maybe a tenth the value that the tax is due on. You may not get enough from the sale of the land to pay the taxes on the value of the land. That's the problem with taxes based on value of something at a given date, because values on given dates are based on estimates. And this is the hardest thing for people to understand in the market, because when you get your statement that tells you what your stocks are worth, in front of the number there's a dollar sign. Nowhere on there does it say an estimated value of. It just says this is how much you have. The reality is you do not have that much money if you own stocks. You own a stock that is estimated to be worth that much money. If you went to sell that and everybody with that stock went to sell it on the same day, it would not be worth that much money. The price would drop. That's just an auction market. If everybody goes to auction and says, I want to sell my grand piano at the same time, the price of grand pianos will go down because everybody's trying to sell them and there are not that many people trying to buy them. On the reverse side, if everybody decides to go in and when they want to buy grand pianos and there's not enough to go around, it causes the price to go up. This is supply and demand. If we have an external demand that didn't exist before, isn't part of people's decision-making process on why they own something, it becomes very dangerous. And so I think you can get from my answer to that, that I believe that that form of taxation would not increase revenue to the government. It might in the first year, but it would tank revenue to the government going forward. It might put us in a depression. It's a big bad way of taxing. Taxation on a broad scale has to be really well thought out and tested in advance, not just, let's try this. Yeah. You can try it. Good luck. I would like to have my money in cash if that's the case. All right, so we got some commercials to play. We'll be back on the other side. I have a lot to talk about, and I really appreciate the calls. Thanks for keeping my brain awake. It's helping quite a lot. I'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to join the conversation, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400. I'll be back. And I'm back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. I've got a few more minutes this hour. We're about 11 and a half minutes to the end of the hour, and I wanted to talk about something that happened on Thursday. Okay, so I've got some groundwork I have to lay first. Thursday afternoon in Europe, so that's early in the morning in the United States, Thursday afternoon, the European Central Bank cut interest rates on their interbank lending rate by 0.1% and announced that they were going to start buying bonds again on the market. Why? What is this about? Well, this is another form of it's starting back up on the quantitative easing. People remember that from the recovery from the recession. It took Europe a long time to get started on quantitative easing, and then when it did, it slowly pulled itself out of the recession. What is quantitative easing? It's when the central bank is buying up bonds, government bonds, mortgage bonds from the market to infuse money into the market. If you own a bond, you can't really go out and spend it. This is kind of the same subject we were talking about a minute ago. If you have a tax on that bond based on its value, you might have to sell the bond to pay the tax. All right, so if the European Central Bank wants to put some money in the economy, what are people going to do with money? Well, in tough times, they may turn around and buy another bond with it. They might stick it back in the bond. But that at least gives somebody else some cash. Whoever they bought it from, whomever they bought it from, they presented cash to that person. Now that person has the cash. Why did they decide to sell? Because they wanted the cash. What are they going to do with it? They might buy something. Well, that stimulates the economy. Starts the money moving around again. Inflation and deflation don't really have to do with the total money supply. It has much more to do with the money supply that's being used, the money in circulation. What is in circulation? Well, if you have $200,000 in your bank account and you haven't touched it in 5 years, that's not considered to be in circulation. You're not using it to buy things with in the market. The bank may have used it to give loans out to other people to buy things, but the money in your account is not moving around. So it's not stimulating anything. It's just hanging out. The more money that just hangs out, the less money there is in circulation. That leads to deflation. The less money that just hangs out, the more money that's being moved around, if it happens relatively quickly, can lead to inflation. So it's not just how much money's being created, it's also how much money's being used that determines inflation and deflation. Okay, so they're buying back the bonds, they're trying to get money flowing again because the trade war is really impacting Europe at a much more negative way than it is the United States. Germany is a major powerhouse in Europe. It is the major engine in the European Union. There are two other or three other major engines. There's France, there's the UK, and there's Italy. Well, Italy's kind of lagging and has been. It's sputtering along. It's barely in the growth side. Germany has been for the past several years. Its growth rate, its GDP, has been measured in below 1% a year territory. And now it's negative. So it hasn't been extremely healthy to now, and now it's unhealthy. It's receding. It's shrinking as far as its economy goes. And we're in the middle of the next quarter or near the end of it, so we won't know if they're in recession. They might be in recession right now, but we won't know about it until we get the data on this quarter. Well, the European Central Bank sees this and they say, all right, we're going to lower interest rate. That means loans are cheaper to get. Well, that's the old thought because they're harder to get when they're cheaper to get. Banks don't give them very well. But on the other side, they're buying back bonds. That puts cash in the market. Okay, this immediately caused the European markets to tank, followed by immediately jumping up. Okay, perfect. No problem. I think that laid the groundwork on what happened in Europe. And that happened early in the morning. Enough time for us to fully comprehend it. No major movements up and down in the market at the opening of the markets in the United States. But then you come forward about an hour into the day, or a little less than that, into the day. And suddenly on the graphs, I'm looking at this as I'm going about my business on Thursday. See the graph? And you have this cliff upward. in the stock market, in the Dow Jones Industrial Average, not the market, the indexes, the market as well. So I started flipping around between all the different indexes, all the different markets, and it's all there. There's this cliff upwards. What happened there? And then it jumped up and then flattened out, stayed flat for a little bit, and then had a cliff downwards about the same amount. So you have this weird plateau on the graph. Very steep sides, not jumpy, bumpy sides like you would see normally in the graph, but very, very steep, like cliff. Straight line up, straight line down. What was that? Most people don't care. And one of the things that allowed this to be even visible on the graph is we didn't move very much in any of the markets on Thursday. The Dow Jones Industrial Average on that day closed up 0.17%. Very, very little movement. So when you're looking at a graph for just that day, it makes all the tiny movements during the day look really big because it gets scaled down to that size. Just think like a microscope that's getting zoomed in so you can see the actions. So that's the only reason why we could see this little blemish in the graph. What is it? In order to understand what it is, you have to understand something else. There are firms out there, money management firms, that are called quant firms or algorithmic traders. All they are is a firm that has written a program of some kind with a whole lot of variables that say things like when oil prices hit this mark, buy this stock. Whatever it is that particular quant firm thinks causes something to go up or down, they input those variables. And there's a lot of quant firms now. And all of them have lots of variables. What we had on Thursday morning was the president tweeted. The president tweeted and was not very kind to the Federal Reserve and was very, very kind to the European Central Bank in the tweet. Well, let me tell you what happened here. The computer doesn't know at all who he was being kind to in that tweet. So a quant firm can take any variable that there's a data feed for and feed it into the system and say, when this data feed does this, do that. So think if there are keywords in a tweet that the computer's looking for. When the president tweets about the Federal Reserve and uses words like strong or very fine, they're saying, all right, buy the market. When he uses words like failure or lame or sad in the same tweet with the Federal Reserve, sell the market. Okay. So now we have a tweet where the Federal Reserve is mentioned, and he used his non-standard kind of insults to the Federal Reserve. None of the normal ones that the quants say, all right, he'll use these ones to talk badly and these ones to talk greatly about the Federal Reserve. What he did use is big compliments to the European Central Bank. So the quant firm's computers assumed from that tweet that the president is talking about how good the Federal Reserve is. And if you look back over the last couple of years, when the president talks highly of the Federal Reserve, we tend to have a slight bulge upward in the market, not a big one, just a little gradual blip upward. And when he talks badly about them, we have a slightly larger blip downward. It generally stabilizes within a few minutes or a few hours, but we have a slight bulge up or down depending on how he's talking about the Federal Reserve. Well, enough quants have gone out there, are out there, and they're looking at Twitter and saying, hey, when he tweets about it like this, it goes down. When he tweets about it like that, it goes up. So over the past about 4 months, as the president has tweeted about the Federal Reserve, that market movement has gotten bigger. And the quants, each of them individually, are out there going, hey, we figured out some secret of the market. Oh, we jump in here and it works. What's really happening, the reason why that bulge is getting bigger in the upside and bigger on the downside, is because more and more quants are getting involved. They are affecting the market. And what happened on Thursday was a bunch of quants all bought using the wrong information, and then sold 5 minutes later when Mario Draghi, who's the European Central Bank outgoing chairman, said, He didn't mean that this is what he meant. So there was some manual trading that happened right there, and you've got these steep lines, and we may have avoided a massive disaster there because the quants are now going to be looking at that event and saying we shouldn't allow the computer to trade on a tweet about the Federal Reserve for these criteria. They'll add more criteria. So that means that we probably won't have a massive 1987-style crash based on a presidential tweet from a quant firm. But there may be another reason why we do. If enough quant firms find one variable and all jump on into it, and they have enough money to trade all at once, you can cause big movements up and down in the market. And I can talk about what happened in 1987 next hour, because that was long enough ago that a lot of the listeners were not even born yet. So I'll talk about how portfolio insurance and making things safer caused one of the most famous crashes of the 20th century. I'm about out of time for this hour. If you'd like to contact the firm, the personal wealth coach, off the air, you can call a local number to get voicemail at 254-947-1111 or toll-free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, and you'll read newsletters there. You can sign up for the newsletter. You can download recordings of the radio program going way back. We'll be starting a podcast relatively soon. That's probably going to get stuck up there too. You can contact me through the site or email directly jake@tpwc.com. I'm sure Jeff would like it too. Jeff@tpwc.com. Until next hour, this has been